welcome to episode 92 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Douglas Konopelko. I heard Doug speak during an Ignite session at ISTE and instantly sent him a DM to invite him on the show. He's the coordinator of digital learning for Martin County School District on the east coast of Florida, and he focuses on the implementation, planning, and instructional use of technology in that district. He's also a father and a graphic designer. Doug and I talk about our thoughts on ISTE 19, his Ignite talk on screen time quantity versus quality, communication issues in education, and how often miscommunication hurts us, the difference between problems with internal and external communication, how educators need to be more transparent with their audiences, the need for learners to allow for failure in their staff, and the value of using your students as resources in your classroom. So, sit back and enjoy episode 92 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Douglas Konopelko. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler, and I am really excited because it's just after ISTE. I've been back for less than a week by the time I'm recording this, and while I lost an episode I recorded while I was at ISTE, which was one of the most depressing moments of my life, I am really excited to get to start talking to some of the people I met while I was out there, and one of those is my guest this week, who is Doug Konopelko. Oh man, I even asked you before I started and I still messed it up. Doug Konopelko. I hope I got that right. Doug, how are you doing, man? Oh, I'm terrible. I'm the worst.
Good. Listen, hey, you nailed it. You nailed it. It took two tries, but you nailed it.
Oh God. You know, this is what happens when you make me do a 6:30 record, a 6:30 a.m. record on a weekday and it's summer. So, Doug, first of all, I saw you speak at ISTE, and you talked about, you did an Ignite session, which, as someone who presented at Ignite last year, totally get how much work goes into those. It is, you would think for a five-minute presentation, oh, that'll be easy. I spent so much more time working on that five-minute presentation than the hour-long presentation I gave this year. I don't know about you, but...
Yeah, 100%. I can't even tell you how many times I practiced that, only to also be kind of thrown a little bit of a curveball when we got there, because the last 2 years, the person was standing in the middle of the stage, no podium, no nothing. So
I noticed that this year. That was weird.
So we all prepped based on watching those videos, and then we got there and they said, okay, you have to stand behind the podium. And all of a sudden, everybody said, well, great, I can bring up my notes. And so then everyone brought up notes. And once you've practiced something without notes 100 times, and then you have your notes, you tend to look down at them. And until about 5 slides in, I kept looking down at my notes. And it was actually throwing me off because I was so used to just delivering it that finally, I just said to myself, okay, I'm not looking down anymore because I'll never get through this if I keep looking down at these notes.
So I want to talk about your specific Ignite because it was really fascinating and something that's been on my mind a lot. I want to get to that, but I want to start because we are just fresh back from ISTE. It's only been, you know, a handful of days since the conference ended. And I want to talk a little bit about the conference in general. And given that you've seen the previous Ignites and Ignites are my favorite part of ISTE every year. They're the thing I don't miss. And I was brokenhearted that they overlapped the session I presented with the second round of Ignites. It just ruined my conference. But maybe exaggerating a little bit, but man, it really crushed me. Given the attendance during your round of Ignites and the attendance at the third round on Wednesday and the change to the format, I'm a little concerned that we might see Ignites leave ISTE coming up. And that worries me.
Yeah, I don't know. So I have only watched the Ignites and actually anything from ISTE through these digital boxes in front of us. I have not. This is my first year attending. So,
Oh, that's so much more interesting. So, what did you think of ISTE then? Tell me your impressions as a first timer.
So it was very, very large. And that's coming from a place where I'm not going to say that we have a similarly sized event, but what used to be Florida's EdTech conference is one of the larger state conferences. I mean, it's not a state.
People ask me about FETC, and I always say it's pretty much the second largest educational conference.
So I mean,
there's nothing else like it except ISTE.
Right. So after having done FETC 5 or 6 times, going to ISTE was definitely very different. I also think that the convention center there in Pennsylvania was just so huge and really spread out that you could have a solid 15-minute walk between sessions, which was definitely interesting. but yeah, I think it's just anything when you get to that scale, it's hard to keep it as organized as something smaller.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it is an interesting conference. I love ISTE. This was my 5th or 6th year. I'm not sure. 5th or 6th year, one or the other. And I love that conference. I tell people it's my annual Mecca trip that I have to do. And I always get phenomenal, you know, networking opportunities, meeting with people that I talk to online all year. It seems like everybody I know is in one city at one time, you know, and it's awesome. But it is, there are parts of the size that can definitely hurt it, I think.
Yeah, I think overall it was a great conference. I got to see, like you said, a lot of people that are in my PLN that I don't get to see almost any other time of year. So that was powerful to be able to walk 5 minutes away and have a great conversation with someone that normally I can only talk to back and forth on Twitter or another social network.
What was the best session you were able to attend?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I actually, similar to what you said, I really enjoyed the other Ignite talks that happened surrounding mine. That was also the thing I was most keyed into for the week. So, I mean, I would still say that because you got a lot in a short period of time. There was a few really powerful talks. I know one, I'm going to forget everyone's name because I was so nervous giving that talk. and then also everyone was trying to document for each other, you know, because the professional learning networks that everybody has are so tight that as everyone went up to present, everybody that was backstage was like trying to take pictures of that person presenting while also going over their notes and everything else. But so I was really kind of blown away by the different stories in the Ignite talks. There was one delivered by a student who had suffered from anxiety issues her whole life and talked about some of the coping mechanisms she had been taught to help her through school. So that was really powerful.
Hers was really good. I enjoyed hers. And in your group, I also thought the kid that built GimKit was there.
Yes.
Which was super cool. And hearing him talk about how he created this as a school project and it meant so much more, that was neat. And I mean, you can't go without mentioning Jennifer Casatad being in your group. I mean, she's amazing.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Yeah, I do love Ignites. They're typically my favorite part. And they, like you said, you get the kernel of an idea, you get the explanation of an idea. And then if you want more, you do what I do and you reach out to the people and go, hey, I'd really like to hear more about this. Can we talk more?
Yeah. So for you, it being your 5th or 6th year, how did you feel about the conference and what did you see that you found powerful?
So first of all, I have to point out, because last year there was a lot of frustration with lines and getting into sessions and sessions being overbooked. And this was huge improvement this year. I, all week, only one session I wanted to get into was I not able to get into. And it was a Matt Miller session, so it's not surprising that filled up. So I thought that, number one, they listened and they fixed some of those issues, and that was huge. I think that was a great, a huge improvement on the part of the committee and making those sessions, you know, more manageable and balanced. I think the most obvious complaint, and I think sort of the meme of ISTE, was Wi-Fi issues, which is odd to me because it's an educational technology conference. Your Wi-Fi should work. Yes. And when when even the presenter network isn't working, that's a little bit of a problem because we depend on internet to do presentations. So when I did my presentation, there was four of us presenting together, and we ended up having to run off of someone's hotspot on their phone because we couldn't rely on the internet at the conference, which is a little strange. One last complaint to knock out is I desperately wish that this conference would put together a halfway decent app. Their app has so many problems every year. It's just a mess. It lost I went through Saturday and favorited all the stuff I wanted to see. Woke up Sunday morning and everything I favorited was gone. It was like 3 hours of work and it was gone. And I was livid. So I would love to see that app get some improvement. Now, positives. I still love this conference. I leave this thing every time feeling like it was just magic, and I'm so pumped and excited to come back and change the world. It always leaves me with this warm, fuzzy feeling. I got to hang out with people I only get to see at this conference. You know, shout out to Jonathan Spike because I got to hang out with him a ton this week, and it was super fun. We had a great time both in the conference and outside, going to hang out and check out Philly a lot. You know, I got to hang out with Glenn Irvin and Mike Washburn of On Education. I got to hang out with my man, Dan Krynas of Leader of Learning Podcast. We had an education podcasters meetup on Sunday at PAX King of Stakes, and that was amazing. And that resulted in being at a bar with four podcast educators and I just talking about not education, which was super fun. It was an amazing conference, amazing ideas shared around. I loved the Ignite sessions, as always. And yeah, you know, I got some great information, some great ideas, and I'm so excited to sort of implement some of those now that I'm back and getting ready to start doing some of my summer working days at my office.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned too about the having the conversations about not education, because I think that sometimes that's the most powerful stuff. I like reading books that are not education, because I think that they can hold really good kernels that weren't intended for educational use, but end up being great for the work world and for education in general. So it always is really great to be able to have those types of conversations.
Yeah. You know, and I think back to, I think it was during your session, your Ignite sessions, there was one of the, I'm going to pull up my notes to make sure I get this. Dr. Virginia Duncan went on shortly before you.
Yes.
And specifically talked about the idea of thinking outside the box being a flawed premise. And that's one of the things she brought up is, you know, thinking that there even is a box to think outside of is flawed because it limits our ideas, and we need to be looking everywhere for ideas. And so even though those conversations were not directly about education, it can bring interesting ideas directly into our classrooms and into our practice, which is, you know, that's the important stuff, is when we're not expecting an epiphany to hit us, and that's when it comes from. So I think it's cool.
Definitely.
Well, I want to talk about your Ignite because it hit a spot for me, because it's my son is 7 years old, and as you can imagine, like any 7 year old who has, you know, a technology coach as a father, but just really any 7 year old, screen time is one of those things that is a button in my mind where I'm heavily thinking about how much time is he spending in front of a screen. And what time is he spending in front of a screen? And I think that sort of directly relates to your Ignite. So can you give me, first of all, the elevator pitch, and then let's just sort of chat it out?
Sure. So one thing that I think is funny, actually, and you bring that up, is it's such a common conversation. And it's so common, not only just as a conversation, but just in day-to-day life, to encounter someone who happens to be talking about screen time. So the big thing, you know, especially being in education and technology, is to talk about whether or not a kid has a device in their hand, right? So when we're talking about, you know, from board meetings to the classroom, people are constantly talking about people having devices in their hands, and students, teachers, all over. So what's really interesting is what you rarely hear people talk about is what those students or what those kids are doing on the device. So that's sort of the premise of where the presentation started from. So the title was Don't Vilify the Device. And basically, my goal was just to throw some information out there about the device by itself. It's just, you know, a little electronic box. And depending on what you do with it, that's what really makes the difference. Because whether or not you're on it isn't really relevant. It's what you're doing once it's in your hand and what you're using it for. Because obviously there's a big difference between, you know, the example I use is scrolling through social media versus making a video that's going to share the powerful things going on for students in your school. So those are two things you can do on a device. They might even look pretty similar to someone who's just watching someone on a device, but, you know, wildly different in the outcome and whether or not someone would call that positive use.
Yeah. You know, some of the images you used, you know, both metaphorical and the literal images on your screen, you talked about a kid looking at his phone and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this was you from what I remember. But you talked about a kid looking at his phone and how do you, like at a bus stop or at a bench, and you may think he's just scrolling through or playing Fortnite, but what if he's looking up directions to find, you know, find his way home or get food or something? Or why would we expect a kid to walk around with a map, but then vilify, you know, we would never expect a kid to walk around with a physical map in their hands, but then be like, well, what's he doing spending so much time on his phone? Right. So I think it's such an interesting concept. And in my summary of it that I tagged you in, it, to me, it was really a question of screen time quantity versus screen time quality. Right. And there's two different discussions there.
Right. Right. And I think what's interesting is people will sometimes not even view when they're on a device for directions or when they're on a device for something that's positive. They don't even think of that as them really using their device, right? They're, oh, well, I'm not, I'm just getting directions. And you're thinking, well, right, but you're still holding it and you're still using it. So when, you know, a kid or a student does that and we get all over them, and listen, that's not to say that we don't see the other kind of use going on in schools and in classrooms. Obviously, we see both, but we also see both from our teachers and our leaders. So it's important to know that that's just an important part of understanding the whole picture.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, now that I'm thinking about it, as I'm thinking back in your talk, I really think I am going to show that to my students at the beginning of the year this year, this coming school year, because I think it does get the message across that I've been trying to get to my students. You know, my students, as their tech support interns, they have downtime in the classroom where they have other things to do. And I don't really want them just mindlessly watching YouTube sports clips. I want them using that time to create something and take advantage of it. It's not that I don't want them to touch technology. It's that I want them to use it for a more productive purpose. And I think that's what, to me, that's what I took from your presentation, was we need to be doing the screen time for the right things and the creation components that are, you know, critical importance going forward in the future. And not just to be consumers mindlessly of content scrolling through a intentionally designed to be addictive feed, right?
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, yeah, you know, like some of the examples were a little extreme, but it helps to make the point. And one of the things, so I did an iPad pilot in my classroom, I'm going to say 7 years ago now. And one of the things we talked a lot about was the behavior and what the behavior looks like in the classroom. So one of the signs that I had made for my classroom said, you know, there was two categories. One said above desk level and one said below desk level, right? And the idea was, if you're using your device for something that's school-based, you'll be using it on top of your desk and you'll just, it's the easiest way to use it. It makes the most sense to use it sitting on top of your desk. If you're using it below your desk, then that's a behavior that's showing me that you're probably doing something that you're not supposed to do and you're trying to keep it from me, right? So I tried to clarify some of those things as well with my class, because as a teacher, you're already thinking that, right? And helping visualize that and show your thinking to the students makes it a little easier.
I like that. It's kind of a simple mechanic of, you know, they already know what they should and shouldn't be doing in class. And so that's a very easy way to visualize that and explain that. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah. I think it's always interesting too, because of my role in, you know, at the district level, is I'll get calls all the time about, well, we need to put something together that shows kids what they're supposed to be or what they're not supposed to be doing on devices. And I said, no, they already know, because doing the assignment for school or research for school compared to, you know, getting off the Wi-Fi so that they can get on Snapchat, they already know that that's not appropriate. You don't need to have a sign that says that's not appropriate. No one, none of the students are going onto social media during school and thinking, this is what I should be doing with this time.
Yeah, I think you're right. You also made me realize that I am clearly rusty on podcasting, because I did not even ask you or to explain who you are and what your role is. So maybe we should do that. Since, you know, we're only like 20 minutes into the podcast, who cares if the people know who you are? So, Doug, if you could, who are you in the field of education?
Hey, that's a great question. I'm glad we started with that. So,
professional to the extreme.
So my name is Doug Conopelco. I am the coordinator of digital learning for Martin County School District, which is on the east coast of Florida, South Florida. And what that role is essentially the district level administrator for instructional technology. So not the hard networking, programming, IT side, but rather the educational side, the implementation, the planning, the instructional use of digital resources across the district. It also encompasses audiovisual equipment from a layover of the days of yore. So those are really the big makeups of it. And now more than ever, it also includes a lot of instructional materials work because of how digitally those materials have gone. So that's what I do during the day with most of my hours. I've got 3 kids, 6, 5, and 1. So I don't sleep. And I have a graphic design business on the side as well. This was my first ISTE this year, but I've spoken at a number of different conferences, mostly local to Florida, FETC, FATIMA, which is the District Instructional Materials Administrators, FADES, which is the Florida Association of Educational Data Systems. I did one conference out in Texas, but this was, for the most part, one of my first ones outside the state. And really, I just try to focus on my work during the day and at these conferences on understanding what's out there and understanding really what would this look like in a classroom, because what it looks like at a conference or in a presentation in a boardroom is very different than what something looks like when it's implemented. So that's me in a nutshell.
I like it. You know, it's one of those things that about Florida, I think, or maybe it's just about the world in general, but you know, I'm knowing where Martin County is and where I am, you're probably no more than an hour and a half or so from where I live, and we've never connected at any of these conferences before. That's crazy.
Yep.
It's real weird.
And then I guess a little more on the background end real quick was that I taught in Palm Beach and Martin County, and then I was an assistant principal in St. Lucie County. And then came back to Martin in this role. So
nice. I have horrible memories of St. Lucie, but that's honestly has nothing to do with St. Lucie and more to do with why I was there. cool. First of all, again, you know, I really do appreciate you joining me. I'm just going to act like this is the beginning. And, you know, a better podcaster than I would probably just shift this to the beginning and edit it and make it sound like he was professional, but I'm not that podcaster. So. But, you know, I really do appreciate you joining me on the show. I feel like we've already had some interesting talk about sort of quantity versus quality. And I want to get to my 3 questions. But before I do that, I want to go backwards again. And we're just going to do this whole thing like a weird, odd, time-shifted movie and go backwards again and ask, you know, from your talk and your presentation on screen time quality versus quantity kind of thing, do you have any actionable suggestions, some quick tips, if you will, for what a parent or an educator might do to sort of, or to take away from your presentation?
So 2 things I would say. One is, in any conversation surrounding screen time or anything else, along those lines, digital usage, to really actively listen and be a part of the conversations without going in saying, well, being on a screen is bad right off the bat. So the one of the biggest things, of course, is that active listening piece. And the second suggestion mirrors it a little bit. And I would just say asking questions rather than, you know, coming in firing on, you know, what you think is right and appropriate is a really good place to go. So especially true when you're talking with the students or with your children. I know that I had to try to become better once I realized this and I thought about, okay, what am I modeling as an adult for kids? You know, I had to look at my own usage and think about what am I showing the world that I'm doing? And does it look like I'm just buried on a device? Because if I'm in a meeting and I'm sitting there on a device taking notes during a meeting looks identical to being on Instagram during a meeting. So it's really important that I ask questions and be an active participant. And then, especially with my own children, like you said, you have a 7-year-old. I have a 6 and a 5-year-old who really, you know, use devices, but we have a lot of conversations around what are they doing on the device. We're really careful about what we load onto the device, especially for a 5 and 6-year-old, soon to be 6 and 7. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it is just communication.
Okay. I like it. One more question occurred to me while you were talking, and I'm just gonna go to it because my own personal dilemma here. When if we look at a quantity of screen time versus quality, or I guess if we look at the quality of the screen time as sort of a spectrum from total creation ranging all the way up to just consumption, because I believe there's not a black and white there, right? And I don't think it's one, it's either or, creation or consumption. And to me, that's the sort of extreme ends, you know, of what I would want to see device use for is creation, not just consumption. But sometimes some kinds of consumption could be, you know, learning based, and sometimes of creation could be just for fun and no other real purpose. But just looking at that as like kind of a spectrum, where do video games fall for you? Or was that a completely convoluted question that made no sense?
So, no, I'll answer it. So I think that's a great example because that's a genre, right? So that's not a specific item. It's really hard to say where a genre would fall on, you know, on a spectrum of creation to consumption. There are games out there that are almost entirely consumption where you as the user are doing very little. There are games out there where you as the user are doing almost all creation. I think of something like Minecraft and creative mode in Minecraft, where there isn't, even though it's all creation, you can go into creative mode and do almost nothing. You can just be putting blocks on top of blocks and nothing's really happening and you're not really, there's not a ton of thinking going on. Even though it's creation, it's still sort of passive and entertainment based. And then you can go into creative mode of Minecraft and and try to really build things and put things together. And even though that's the same mode inside the same game, it really shifts what the usage looks like. And then obviously if you go into, I might get the name wrong, survival mode in Minecraft, that,
yep, you're right.
Then there's all different kind of stipulations around what you can and can't do and how you make it through the game. So it's really hard to put that on a spectrum, but I would also say that I look at it from three different angles, right? And creation versus consumption is just one of those. I also look at whether the content or the user has to be actively engaged or if they can be kind of passively engaged in it. So something like just watching a video is something you can just be passively engaged with. And then also whether it's educational in nature or entertainment. So hard to say just creation or consumption. If I could find a way because I'm a big visual model person, which I'm sure James Dean of Thinking Maps would be happy to hear. I was re-listening to his episode this morning. So if I could find a way to show three different qualities and how they interact with each other, I'd love that, because I really think it's more powerful to be able to see something. But I look at it on all three of those levels, not really just the creation or consumption side.
I'm in my head, I'm visualizing a one of those that I don't even know what they're called, but like they have them in video games a lot, actually. But the charts that usually they're a pentagon, and it's like the five metrics, and different parts of it are shaded different amounts. So to show like different elements that a character might be strong in, but in this case, the sort of a ranking or a display for the subjective quality of an app or a function of a product on the screen, where it's like kind of, if it's all creation and awesome and learning and everything else, then this whole other side is shaded, and that's like a good screen time use. Which, by the way, none of this is any good for audio. And this is probably like one of the worst, like most unprofessional interviews I've ever done. And you're doing great. I'm just terrible. I'm clearly out of practice at podcasting today. So I'm visualizing this cool display. And this actually might be one of the only things I ever cut out of one of my own episodes, because I'm realizing it makes no freaking sense.
No, I get it. I get it. So the only difference I would say is that what you'd have to do, because I'm taking notes too as we go, is in those, right, each line or each section represents a specific attribute of the character, right? So like speed would be one of them. So because we're looking at something that has two ends of the spectrum, right, creation and consumption, you would just have to call that section creation. And if something was really low, the understanding would be that it's consumption. And then, you know, on the educational side, if something was really low, you just have to understand it's entertainment, but you'd really only give it kind of one name to fit into that model. But I'm with you. I'm okay with that.
So it'd be like a, so it would be a triangle in this case.
Yep.
And it would be empty triangle if it's useless screen time. I wouldn't say useless, but not useful for educational purposes. And so it'd be an empty triangle. But if it's a great app where they're actively engaged, they're learning from it, and they're creating things, then it would just be a nice full circle or triangle of all the shading. I think I just gave you an idea for a book. Good job. You can have it. It's all yours.
I appreciate it. Yep. And I know what I won't say after listening again to James is that I won't say it's going to be a triple Venn, because not doing that.
Yeah. No, don't touch it. Don't do it. Awesome. Very cool. All right. Well, that was a long, rambly description and completely unfocused and out of chronological order, because it's 6:30 in the morning and my coffee's just now starting to kick in.
And listen, that's how it goes. That's how education talk goes, right? It's confusing. It's jumbly, but we get there.
Yeah, you know the best part is, and my audience hasn't had an episode in 3 weeks because I lost an episode last week, and it made me very, very sad. Don't worry, Mike Washburn's coming back. We're going to get it figured out, even though I lost his episode. But now, after waiting 3 weeks, they get 32 minutes of just ramble and out of order stuff where I just am not being a good interviewer. So welcome back from the break, guys. All right, let's roll right into my actual three questions for my guests and talk about the real stuff here. And as you've mentioned, you've heard a couple episodes of the show, so you're not going to be surprised by my first question, but I'm gonna roll with it. So the first question I ask all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
So I did listen to a couple episodes, and I realized other people had some really great answers to that question. But I really think it goes back to something we were just talking about, and it's that I think it's miscommunication. Because I even think about pieces like when people say things along the lines of, oh, this new district initiative. And before I was at the district level, I was 100% guilty of saying those same things. Then I got to the district level and realized that half of the quote unquote new district initiatives are based on a new statute that has been put into place that you have to come up with a way to figure out how is this going to go into education. And a lot of times we'll get that information, you know, during legislative session. So in May, you'll find out here's a totally new thing you have to implement next year based on statute. And how you communicate that out and the amount of time you have to then get that done is really limited and difficult. And I think that that happens across the board, right? So I think that probably on the legislative end, they get information that says, here's what needs to change, and they do their best to change it, not knowing the time it takes to put together an initiative like that. And then we pass it down to school site level, and they are doing the same, trying to do their best to get things implemented that they hear need to be implemented. And I think that's obviously a longer, bigger issue than just communication, but that's a huge part of how those things get passed down from level to level. And I think, so that's a piece of it. And I think also just with the miscommunication comes honesty and openness of communication and understanding here's why we're doing X and Y. It goes into that idea of research versus putting things into practice. So when we talk about the disconnect between, you know, research says that retention is that harms kids, but if you look around the state of Florida, every district retains kids, right? I think some of that still boils down to communication. Like, here's why we still do it. And we understand that there's research out there. We're not ignorant to the research, but here's why we continue to do this practice. So I think there's, you know, a lot of it just comes down to communication.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of quantifying or qualifying communication issues as sort of internal and external. So I think on the one hand, that sort of district initiative example is an internal communication we're not having. It's an internal miscommunication where the district is not being transparent in saying we're required to do this because of, you know, legislative item MB217641 or whatever. You know, they're not necessarily explaining the where this is coming from. They're, in my experience, often coming from authoritative positions of we're saying to do it, just do it. But then I think some of those other ones are external communication issues. You know, internally in education, we know the research that says retaining students is not good for students. But externally, all people remember, oh, failing was a thing. You can fail school. Why on earth wouldn't you be able to retain people? That doesn't make sense, right? And I think that especially with some of the more innovative and progressive ideas in the educational space, they seem crazy to parents and to outside educators because they're not the way school was done when we were in school. So, and there's a communication issue where we're not putting forth the message of here's what's wrong with school. And yes, it was broken when you were there too. And now all of a sudden, when we try to do these innovative things, parents, they put it on the 6 o'clock news and say, local school district is not going to fail anybody anymore because they don't want to upset feelings. It's like, no, that's not why. It's because research says this actually works and we have all the evidence to prove it. Right. So I think there's, I think you're right in that there is definitely communication issues. And I think some of it's internal and some of it's external. Would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah. And that is not something unique to any one district or any one entity, or any one person right there. That would definitely go as a, if we're creating the characters though, on that, on your pentagon shape from before, you know, communication would definitely exist on a spectrum. It would definitely be an attribute of an organization or of an individual, but you know, it's a system, right? It's all things working together and how they work together, and you know, culture impacts what the communication is in organizations, because if you have a culture of open communication in your organization, then obviously you know, the individuals within it learn and grow more in the area of communication. So definitely there are internal and external factors there. And I think that that translates all the way down to the students, right? Where, you know, when you talk about here's why we're doing this, that's not only important to the teacher, That's also really important to the students, right? The largest stakeholder group we have, the one that's most often excluded from those communications. So always really important to bring it back to the students.
Interesting. What do we do, whether it's in your position at the district level or at a school level or even at a teacher level, whatever that may be, what do we do to sort of address these issues? Because I certainly don't think these are new. And like you said, they're very widespread. They're not unique to any one school district. So what do we do to sort of address some of this stuff?
So what everyone can do is, with the audience that you already have, be more open and honest and communicative with that audience, right? So not everyone has a global audience, right? So some people might have an audience of just the other teachers on their team, right? So to kind of lay out there, hey, I'm going to really try to be more open and honest in my communication. It might be great sometimes, it might feel not so great other times, but if we're consistent with it, it should really improve the way that we communicate as a team. I just finished reading Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams, as I look away from the mic and my sound drops off. Looking on the bookshelf, I can't never remember which one's smart and which one's smarter, but I think it's Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams by Roger Schwartz. And a big part of that was talking about open and honest communication, right? So he talked about getting rid of the compliment sandwich, because if the point of something is to discuss a deficiency or discuss something that needs to be fixed, putting it inside the compliment sandwich doesn't really help, right? It's burying the information that you really need to get to. So just really interesting talk and idea, considering it was based on or goes against everything that you've heard about giving somebody any kind of negative feedback. So again, you have to have a culture of open and honest communication before you can implement that one strategy though. So just really important to get there.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's true. It is bigger than that. Huh. I like it. Well, I'm going to also link to that book in the show notes. So if anybody would like to check that out, there'll be a link to Smart Leaders, Smarter Teams in the show notes there. Yeah, cool. You know, I like it. I enjoy it. I'm a fan. Let's move right along. Cause I think we all can agree with the communication. I think that, you know, there's definitely a need for more transparency. And I think that is something we can do with whatever audience we have. And I think a lot of educators probably wouldn't like that term audience. I think there's still a lot of educators who don't want to be a brand and don't want to consider themselves a voice in this space. But I think even if you don't run a podcast or a blog or even spend time on Twitter, you still can have a voice. You know, I don't think there's very many people now that don't use social media at all. You know, there's not many of those. So I think everybody has a voice and has an audience they can speak to. So I think that transparency and communication is critical. And if I could give one actionable piece of advice, it's maybe try being a little more transparent with your students next year, because we often do leave them out of the conversation and try to protect them from the conversation in a way that is often unnecessary, I think. So
yeah,
I like
it. I think that
actionable, specific.
You know, it's really interesting you saying that too, is of course I just finished a book called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood by Chris Emden, who's an amazing speaker. And if you're in education, you've probably seen his TED Talk at some point, which is what drove me to read the book. But it was interesting because that's what it talked a lot about, was being more inclusive of your students and processes and communication. And so it's funny that the day after I finished that book, you know, we're sitting here talking about being more open and honest with students.
Interesting. I'm going to have to put that one on my to-read list.
Yeah, this has been a big year of books. So if I keep going back to those, it's because there's a lot of information swirling around right now.
It's like me and podcasts. I just listen to a podcast every 5 seconds. I just listen to a podcast. It's become kind of a running joke in my master's program where we know, Brad, you listen to a podcast. We get it.
Yeah. Well, can we, right, can, cool. can we sidebar for a second and you tell me like your top 5 podcasts?
Oh, that's such a complicated question. Yes, we can.
Does not have to be education related, because I think they're a great medium for learning.
Okay, so if I had to pick my top 5, I'll kind of do a say a top 5 is difficult, but I will give you 5 that I will highly recommend at least. I don't know that these are my top 5, but 5 that I would highly recommend are the For Education podcast on education with Mike Washburn and Glenn Irvin. I'm a late comer to this show, but it is phenomenal. And Mike and Glenn are just so cool. So I'm going to have to say On Education with Mike Washburn and Glenn Irvin are up there. Another education one that I really, really enjoy is it's called Ed Conversations, ED Conversations with Shane Lawrence. I love his show. Him and I recently recorded actually his 100th episode, where we kind of just talked about reflecting on being podcasters and what that's like. So highly recommend that. In terms of non-education, I always put Radiolab pretty much up at the top of non-education podcasts, because it is an audio masterpiece. It is an experience. It is not something you want to listen to passively. It's great. And just investigative journalism on these insane stories you would really never believe if they weren't this well investigated. Very Bad Wizards in terms of non-education definitely pops up, because it's a psychologist and a philosopher arguing and debating over issues in psychology and philosophy, and they're amazing. It's very, very inappropriate and a lot of bad words, so I will warn you that. Then there's a warning at the beginning of every episode, but it's both highly intelligent and ridiculously silly, so I enjoy that one. And now you're gonna make me pick a 5th, and I've got so many choices. Okay, so in the ed tech space, I think Google Teacher Tribe is probably about as good as it gets, with Casey Bell and Matt Miller. So if I'm going to pick a 5th, I'm going to throw Google Teacher Tribe on there as my number 5.
It's a solid list.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many more. I'm looking at my list. I listen to, I think, 30 different podcasts right now that are like weekly. It's a problem.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's, I think once people discover it too, that's when they start to really, they just get sucked into the black hole of podcasts, and because there's just so much content and there's so many really high quality practitioners that it makes it tough to say, well, I'll just skip this one.
No, I know. Oh, there's so many. I just don't have time, but I also don't want to skip it. I'm my queue to listen to is 28 hours and 3 minutes. So that'll take a while to catch up on, especially over the summer. I somehow have less time to listen over the summer. How does that work? I
don't get it. Well, 'cause you're not going in the car back and forth, but so yeah, I'm going to give you mine, because they're all non-education.
Okay. Perfect.
But I use them all the time in education. So in no particular order, except for the first one being first, is 99% Invisible. Yep. Because Roman Mars is unbelievable. Then Hidden Brain, Freakonomics, okay, Work Life, yep, and then my last one is, oh, it's specific to a season, the first season of Revisionist History with Malcolm Gladwell. Not season okay. 2, just season 1.
Okay. All right. A lot of NPR making your list there.
Yeah, I guess.
Aren't most of those NPRs?
Yeah, well, Hidden Brain...
99% Invisible, life. I think 99% was originally an NPR show, if I'm not mistaken, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I know he was on, he has his radio stations in Oakland, but I don't know if it was NPR or not, but yeah. Sorry, I got you off education. We'll get back.
No, it's fine. I'm all about it. I'm about it. I wish I listened to more non-education ones, but I have so many people in my PLN that have started podcasts or I met through podcasting, and they kind of take up my priority list a lot of times, just to keep up with my friends. Mm-hmm. So It's good times. Oh, I love it. All right. Good little sidetrack in our rambly weavy conversation, eventually in and out of education. I like it. I'm okay with it. I'm a big fan. We're at 48 minutes. So let's go to my next question. And my next question for all my guests is, what are you doing that you wish all educators would do?
Wow. That's a really good question. So I think what I strive to do that I wish everyone strived to do, whether or not I hit the mark all the time, is a totally different story. But is not just open and honest communication, but being truly curious about what else is going on and what else is out there, and being experimental in that way and supporting people when they do, right? So I have two Brad Schrefflers on my team. And as they come to me with ideas of things they want to try to coach teachers on and help teachers implement in the classroom, I try to be very open in saying or being supportive of that work and letting the results speak for themselves. So I think that that's something that as educators, we don't get a lot of. But I had an administrator when I was a teacher who let me crash and burn. And then when we had the reflective conversation about it, about the lesson, he said, "So was that the first time you ever tried that on the day of your formal evaluation?" And I said, "Yes, that was the first time we tried that in my class." He said, "Wow, that's a real risk. Tell me about that." Right. So we talked about it and it was a learning and growing experience. And it wasn't held against me that the lesson didn't go well. It was more celebrated as a learning experience. So I think that that's something really important that most educators and really as you go up through the ranks is even less supported is being or is trying new things.
Yeah, I think it's critical. And with lots of conversations about how failure should be encouraged and supporting failure and learning from it and everything else. And we rarely find that administrators are actually comfortable with letting their people fail, right? And that example you gave of trying something new on a formal evaluation, that just doesn't happen very often. It's the kind of thing I feel like I would do and I have done before, but I don't think that a lot of people do that. So
yeah,
I think that's good.
Yeah, I like it. I really appreciated too how he started that conversation was, you know, so how do you think that went? And I thought, that's a really nice way of telling me that it was terrible.
Yeah, that's good. But I think it's good that it's, you know, was that brand new? Did you try that? Okay, well then let's work through it. It's not, yeah, that sucked and you fail. Like you're going to be losing money because of a bad evaluation kind of thing. It's let's talk about it. What happened? And if we're going to have innovation and change really happen, we do have to have leadership that's going to support it.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. All right. I'm on board. You know what? I think it's good. I think it's a good one. I think it's something that I definitely would love to see more of. All right. Last one. I feel like we're in a race for these last two questions. We've been so many places and now we're racing to get the last two. But we're gonna make it. We're gonna make it under the wire at less than an hour. I don't know why, but for some reason an hour is sort of my magic number for my show. And no one's telling me it has to be less than an hour, but I don't know. In my head, that's what I think.
Perfect.
About. But let's do it. Last question. One left. Doug, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Ooh. That's a really easy question to give like a really profound answer to, but I'm thinking you want a specific teacher.
That would be my preference, but it's your question. You get to know.
I can do it. Now I'll preface this with saying I had a lot of really good teachers. I really, really loved school. So I think as far as being a good teacher, I was probably pretty easy to please and viewed most of my teachers as good teachers. But I look back, I had a teacher in sixth grade Mrs. Sinclair, and that was the last year where you didn't change for like every class, right? We changed maybe a couple times a day, changed classes, but we had that teacher for a few different things. So the reason I say that is, so I was always a really good speller, which is super useful in life. but so what was really interesting is I remember that, I don't remember the specifics, but I remember that it had to be maybe like 2 months into school. I probably hadn't gotten a word wrong on a spelling test yet. And, you know, you have the spelling test every week, and or at least in, I don't know if they still do that, but we did that still at that point. And I probably hadn't gotten a word wrong yet. And she said, you know what? I want you to be in charge of the spelling test. And that meant that, you know, like I ran it during the test. And for me, in my little nerd brain, that was like, man, this is the best, right? Like I wasn't sitting there taking it. She knew I was going to get all of them right anyway. I think I took it at another time or just quietly off to the side. But I was like running. I'm doing air quotes, which translates really well in audio. that I was running the spelling test. And I remember thinking like, well, this is so nice because this is like what I need, right? Like this is appropriate for me. And this is really, really helpful. And looking back on it as a teacher, especially, I think of like, man, what a solid teacher move. Because as a teacher, then I'm gaining that time back, right? Like I already know Doug knows the words. I'm not going to test them on them. And now who knows what she was doing during that time instead. But as a teacher, I was getting that time back and using the resources I had in the classroom to still accomplish the same tasks. Hmm. So I think thinking back in both my teacher brain and in my student brain, I mean, that worked on both levels.
Hmm. I like it.
So that was, you know, we talk about differentiating all the time. And we talk about that it's really difficult to do effectively. And I think we a lot of times only look at it through the lens of, well, we'll make this extension activity for the kid who gets it, or we'll do this remedial activity for the kid who doesn't, or provide more layered support to the kid that doesn't understand. But thinking about opportunities like that, that's still differentiation, and, you know, really helps.
Yeah. I like your point there because it's almost that improvisational component. And when we talk about differentiation, like you said, it's far too rare that we look at individualized differentiation. We do look at kind of generic group A, group B, group C, you know, that, and it's not, well, I already know Doug is going to get all these right. Why am I making him take the test every time? Let's just let him run the test, you know, and it's, you were getting more involved engagement, if nothing else. You were more invested in that classroom because you got to do that. Whereas before, while you enjoyed the spelling test, they certainly weren't a challenge for you. Now you were getting to do something different that probably was a bit of a challenge for you, right? Standing up in front of the class and reading out those words, there's a learning curve to that side of things, you know? And did she maybe ignite a lifelong passion in you that led to where you are today, or at least started that, right? Set the spark for it. So I think that There's too often we don't look at how differentiated we could actually make our classrooms if we just considered the individual students and their interests and their desires and their strengths and their, you know, and you also mentioned using them as a resource. You know, if your students are a resource in your class and not just the thing to be worked on, what does that do for your classroom?
Yeah, definitely. And I actually just looked this up while we were talking because it's how my brain works. I can't find anything from this year, but it looks like as of last year, she was still teaching there. So, I mean, she's in her, at least as of last year, was in her like 32nd year of teaching. So all in the same district.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll make it 32 years. That seems like
that's encouraging to me, though, because, you know, when you see someone who's a really great teacher, you know, you want them to love teaching and to be in teaching for the long haul. So
true. Man. Doug, yeah, this has been fun.
We're 58:30. You better, if you're going to hit your hour mark, you better wrap it up.
I know. I still got to do intro and close on the back. This is going to be over an hour. There's nothing to be done about it now.
We could probably cut out some talk of us just babbling about something.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a lot of work. Doug, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I really do appreciate it. If my audience would like to get a hold of you, how can they go about reaching you?
The best place for education stuff is just on Twitter, at D Conopelco, and Brad will spell that for you.
The link will be in the show notes, of course. And you can find him on Twitter, which is where I reached out to him. So he definitely is responsive. He responded, I think, like an hour after your Ignite session was done. So, you know, he's on it. He's on top of it. So, but yeah, definitely reach out to Doug. He's got great stuff on his Twitter as well. And again, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Doug.
Thank you.
Doug, thank you so much for joining me on this out-of-order and chaotic conversation. I enjoyed it, even if it probably seems insane to the listeners. To connect with Doug, you can find him on Twitter, at dconopelco. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram, at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or the feedback page on my website, which gives you options for feedback there, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, how valuable is your screen time? Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.